and his fortune over the years. He declared bankruptcy. His wife's psychological health suffered. There was massive collateral damage. If this guy had just been true to himself, he would have ended his marriage in a timelier manner. Yes, his wife may have been devastated, but the type of psychological problem she suffered may not have been as pronounced, and his children would not have been exposed to nearly as much contention. Instead of trusting his spider senses and walking away when he was done, he thought he could keep stuffing himself. When he looks back at the whole picture now, he realizes he got married too young, and for the wrong reasons. He hadn't used good gatekeeping early on in the relationship, and when he finally started to consider making a better decision about his life and that of his family, it was too late. The stakes were far too high, and the damage that came in the wake of the late decision, devastating. So how did he get there, to that place called too late? Could it all have been avoided? Perhaps. When he reflects back, there were external reasons for forcing the marriage issue. Geographic and financial factors pushed their hand, and in the nearsightedness of youth, he asked his beautiful young girlfriend to marry him. As a young man would, he turned to his family for advice, and their guidance was consistent with the societal party line. Her family was even less useful. And despite his spider senses telling him marriage was likely a foolhardy gamble, he ignored it all. "I will be different," he thought. "It will all work out. After all, we're in love." Famous last words. Gatekeeping and our stakeholders. When you think about gatekeeping, keep in mind that making decisions in a vacuum is unrealistic, and that stakeholders do matter. Now, obviously, some integration of expert advice into our decision-making process is not always a bad thing. Turning to a tax expert or financial planner for input on how to invest a sum of money, or a contractor about the viability of a structural improvement on a home purchase, is a different matter. But that's not who or what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about being aware of those with a stake in the game of your life. And those stakes are not always in your best interest. The trick, then, becomes balancing the voices of your stakeholders against what you know is best for you, and that's where gatekeeping becomes critical. Here are some tips on how to manage the competing voices of your stakeholders and your spider senses when you stand at the doorway of a big decision. These are ways to fine-tune your gatekeeping skills. Before asking everyone and their brother for advice, take the time to sit with yourself and think hard about what you want. Think ahead about what you know about your stakeholders and what they are going to say. You know them better than you think, and if you prepare for their reactions, you won't be as blindsided. Practice the rope-a-dope technique. In the legendary Rumble in the Jungle boxing match, Muhammad Ali versus George Foreman, Ali harnessed Foreman's energy and used it against him. In essence, Ali was able to take a stance that allowed him to withstand Foreman's pummeling while backed up against the ropes, instead of dancing away from them. By withstanding the punches, he exhausted his opponent. And then, with one swift jab, it was good night, George. Much like Sun Tzu argues in The Art of War, learn how your opponent fights. Learn to defend against his attack with a goal of exhausting him, and then do what you need to do. By relying on your spider senses, you can strengthen your resolve, protect yourself, use their energy against your stakeholders, and let them exhaust themselves. Even they will get tired of listening to themselves as you listen, acknowledge, smile, and ultimately do what is right for you. Bring some objective sources in, if possible, and ask someone who has some experience with your situation for some guidance. If you want to know what it's like to live in Oregon, ask someone who lives in Oregon. If you want to know what it's like to adopt a child from another country, ask someone who has done it. How to fill your own plate in the first place. Let's put some of these gatekeeping techniques into practice as they apply to eating. If you put the right amount of food on your plate to begin with, you give yourself exactly what you need to enjoy your meal, and you don't have to engage in an internal debate over how much is too much while you're in the middle of dinner and at your weakest. If it's on the plate, you'll eat it for a variety of reasons. Because it's there, to please the others around you, or to avoid the villainy of waste. You're more easily swayed at that point. But if you learn to use portion control when you fill your plate, I'll suspect you'll be satisfied and won't eat for the wrong reasons. Remember, it's not always you who fills your plate. Sometimes other people fill our plates for us, literally, at restaurants, or when you're having dinner at a friend's house. There are some tricks you can employ when you're eating to really help you gatekeep your plate at the outset. Use smaller plates. Don't get lost in the parlor trick that certain colored plates will lead you to eat more or less. If you can't put as much food on the plate, simple logistics will stop you. Don't put platters of food on the table. Instead, fill your plate in the kitchen, step away from the food, and sit down with your portioned meal. Don't go to the kitchen for seconds. Restaurants. Order an appetizer and a salad rather than an entree. Or, if you want the entree, ask if the restaurant offers a half portion. Or, divide the full portion in half immediately and ask them to take away the other half. This messes with a lot of people's heads because they fret about the fact that they paid for all of it. You actually paid for the ambiance, for someone else to cook for you and clean your dishes, and for the electricity in the restaurant. If you eat enough to fill you up, then you got your money's worth. Leave your leftovers at the restaurant. Choose restaurants wisely. Use your gatekeeping skills to select restaurants that offer healthier options. The choices on the menu will be harder to navigate once you're at the table feeling hungry and tempted. Dinner parties. Finishing everything on your plate can get tricky when you're at someone else's house and afraid of insulting the host by leaving food. Here are a few tips that can help you navigate these situations smoothly. Whenever possible, put your own food on your plate at someone else's house so you can choose the right amount. Even offer to help in the kitchen to give you some control over this process. An added bonus, it makes you feel good to be helpful. Get up and toss your own paper plate if it's a more casual setting. Find a good break in the conversation and chuck it. Don't assume the hostess cares how much you ate. Eat what you want, enjoy the conversation, and offer to clear the table. Again, bonus points for helping. If you are directly asked if you don't like the food because you didn't finish everything on your plate, tell a white lie. I ate a late lunch. Or just acknowledge being full and directly state that the food was good. Don't apologize. The why. Gatekeeping is merely good front-end decision-making. At the table, it can simply be how much food you put on your plate or what you order in a restaurant. In life, it's about who you choose as a partner, the school you decide to attend, or the career you pursue. When we heed our spider senses at the beginning of a process and don't allow fear, golden rules, and stakeholders to run the show, we can make better decisions out of the gate instead of having to dismantle or defend them later. By monitoring your decision-making on a daily basis, you'll be better able to not only fill your plate more accurately, but also make better life decisions. The now. An exercise at the table. In the next few weeks, practice gatekeeping at mealtimes. In the first week, just watch yourself. Don't make any changes yet. Observe and ideally document how much you serve yourself, and whether it was easy to only eat what was on the plate and not go back for more. If you put too much on, was it more difficult to pass once it was in front of you? Are there patterns to your eating? Do you take larger quantities earlier in the day or later in the day? With other people, in certain settings, with certain foods. Now do some real gatekeeping. If you notice a pattern of putting too much on your plate, fill your plate, take half of it off, then eat. Eat slowly and reflect on whether you are satisfied with this smaller portion. Practice this in a restaurant. Order something and either split it with a friend or get rid of half of it or whatever amount is needed to create a reasonable portion size, throwing out the rest. Don't take it home with you. Again, ideally record this in your journal. Reflect first on what it was like to toss away the food or have it taken away. How did you feel? Wasteful? Anxious? In control? Then note whether or not you were satisfied after the meal. Reflecting on past gatekeeping errors or successes right now may seem overwhelming, but it will provide important data for your ongoing decision-making. A pattern will likely emerge in which you find that you experienced more confidence, but perhaps more anxiety, in decisions where you listened to yourself. At the table, with your family, or in the office. At the end of this exercise, you will have some insight into the types of stakeholders, fears, and golden rules that impact your ability to gatekeep. This can inform you of your pressure points as you go into future gatekeeping situations. Now, start paying attention. Start small at the table, and then apply it to larger decisions you are facing, major purchases, work, where to take a vacation. As you face decisions and gatekeeping, veer away from the usual pros and cons list, and reflect instead on how fears, stakeholders, and golden rules are impacting this decision and your spider senses. Chapter 6. Using Data Wisely. The other terror that scares us from self-trust is our consistency, a reverence for our past act or word, because the eyes of others have no other data for computing our orbit than our past acts, and we are loath to disappoint them. Ralph Waldo Emerson. I realize you may not really know this, or may have never even thought about it, but we live our lives by the scientific method. We never stop testing and learning. Whether we're aware of it or not, every day we collect data. We try out new things and discover some that work and some that don't. In theory, we should repeat the ones that do work and we should toss those that don't. If we had any sense, we'd operate that way. But we know that's not always what happens. An elegant dance takes place between trusting our spider senses and collecting data. Striving to lose weight is a great example of this. We try diets and exercise, and yet find ourselves in the same place over and over again. This occurs because we often ignore our inner voices and eat things we don't like in ways that don't make sense. We rely on data for many other things, including understanding or knowing how long we should stick something out. When you're frustrated with your boss in a meeting, you don't just get up and quit your job. You can't walk away every time you get aggravated, irritated, or frustrated. Data teaches us that. But in other aspects of life, when there is a much larger stay-or-leave issue facing us down, We need to tap into all that we have learned up to this point to make that decision. We have to give ourselves the freedom to trust our spider senses, quiet our stakeholders, practice good gatekeeping, question the fables of our youths, and face our fears. That's how we think clearly about what we need to do. You will know how long to stick something out in your gut, but more often than not, you will endure it for too long. By reflecting on what we have done, how we feel now, and what we want our lives to look like, we can use our data to inform our spider senses. Data will help you to learn how to sketch out what you want your life to look like, and to then determine the gap between where you are now and what you want in the future, whether this is a new body, a new love, or a new life. These principles can help you get there. What is data, and how does it influence you? Simply put, data is information. So, a website, advice from your mom, and observing a coworker are all forms of data. Sometimes we actively search for data, and sometimes we encounter it by accident, or through someone else. It could be a billboard encouraging you to get a mammogram. The fact is, not all data has the same effect. Some data is objective or impersonal, such as a book or a website that gives you step-by-step advice. You won't feel as though you betrayed the book if you did or did not move forward with a decision. As such, that data does not damage your spider senses. In contrast, your mother may also strongly influence you. Data from her is different. It's less likely to be objective information and much more likely to impact your spider senses. As a scientist, I know we are not above emotion, even though the scientific method is supposed to keep it honest. Even, and perhaps essentially, in science, we may be invested in certain outcomes. We may even try to spin the data we collect in order to support findings that we want, even when the hard numbers don't support it. In fact, the way we protect against this in the scientific world is something we call peer review. Other people read our science and bring their own objectivity to bear, keeping us honest. In real life, we don't have objective peer reviewers. But we do have lots of non-objective folks that would love to weigh in. Data is good. Nobel laureate and psychologist Daniel Kahneman's research, as well as the work of Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert, shows that we do well by sometimes getting other opinions. There are certain kinds of decisions we are not always equipped at making on our own. Our problem is that we don't always know how to consume that data. The trick is balance, balancing the data from the outside with what our spider senses dictate is best for us. Let me use a dieting example. We receive a lot of data about food. Nutrition wonks tell us what we should and should not eat. We learn about white carbs, bad fats, good oils, and on until we are overwhelmed with the number of people telling us what we can and can't eat, without knowing our preferences. This information comes at us from a world that tells us to look a certain way, which is another source of data. Then we need to balance this with our spider senses. When are we hungry? When are we full? What do we like to eat? It's a lot to balance. In the United States, people tend to eat in one of two ways. We either cut out everything forbidden, no sugar, no bread, no pasta, no dessert, or we just eat like drunken sailors, ordering everything and eating it without thinking about it. We lick our overfull plates clean. Many people find that they can't regulate themselves in the presence of challenging foods, so they cut them out completely. Neither is a good idea. This entire book is about learning how to listen to yourself on the inside so you can handle the data that comes at you from the outside. You cannot control the toxic food world in which we reside, but you can control your response. Learning from experience. As we journey through life, we accumulate data in the form of experiences. We learn what works and what doesn't. The wisest people use this experience and then reflect upon it to inform future decisions. But many of us just blindly hold on to the teachings of the past, despite what our experiences tell us. Confucius wisely says, "By three methods we may learn wisdom. First, by reflection, which is noblest. Second, by imitation, which is easiest. And third, by experience, which is the bitterest." Because imitation makes it easy to just do what we are taught, we find ourselves making the same mistakes again and again, and not integrating the sometimes bitter lessons of experience into the noble challenge of reflection. Data and your spider senses. Sometimes gathering data and your spider senses may require taking the long view and making some tough choices. Even spider senses can pull you in different directions. This is where you need to occasionally face down some tough choices and ultimately learn from them so that you can make informed decisions in the future. Jeff and Mary wanted to purchase a home in an expensive housing market and looked long and hard for a property. They resided in a small apartment in an urban neighborhood they loved, but they wanted to own their own house. They wound up getting frustrated, so Jeff suggested they start looking in outlying suburban areas. Mary wasn't convinced. Her spider senses told her that moving away from friends and family was not a good idea. But she also wanted to do right by her husband. Her spider senses were all over the map. She felt like she was damned if she did and damned if she didn't. If she fought for what she felt was right and stayed in the city, even in a small place, she was afraid her husband would resent her. If she gave in and they moved, then she knew she wouldn't enjoy living in this new place, even if they had a lovely home. It was a catch-22. Mary was a pleaser and ultimately went along with the move to the suburbs. She hated it, felt isolated, and it caused tension between them. They eventually took the hit and sold the place. She felt that she had given it a chance. In essence, she collected data. It was a tough lesson, but ultimately a good one, because Mary realized that her spider senses were dead on all along, and she was also glad that she gave it a chance. It made her better able to trust herself down the road, and she felt even more confident in her spider senses. It could be argued that she engaged in poor gatekeeping by choosing to live someplace she did not want, but I viewed it as a chance to use data and experience to inform future decisions. Past gatekeeping mistakes could be our best source of data if we can just learn from them. Sometimes our spider senses place us at an impasse. If we are lucky, we get a chance to test out options. This may come at a cost. In Mary's case, this meant years of living away from family members and familiar places. But it also allowed her to give the option that mattered to Jeff a chance, which was also in line with her spider senses. How to use data effectively. There are a couple of ways to use data. Some of us are data bingers. We ask everyone and their brother for advice, buy every book. I genuinely hope this will be the last advice book you'll ever need. And traverse every website, and by the time we finish, we are numb. On the other hand, some of us are data dieters. We are afraid of data or feedback, so we don't seek any. and just move forward without taking the invaluable lessons of life and others with us. The data dieters might be able to find success in their work if they are really listening to their spider senses. The fact is, if their spider senses are working, ideally they will be able to access and use data to act optimally while still honoring themselves. The fear of information overload can lead data dieters to miss some important and useful information. If your spider senses are on, then you can digest the data without losing yourself. The ideal balance involves making all decisions, particularly big-ticket, spider-sense-driven decisions, yourself, by integrating data from your own past and from the outside in order to make a more prudent decision. Let me give you an example. You may go ahead and quit your job to go back to culinary school based on what you know about yourself, but a little advice may help you score a better-suited program or more financial aid. So you understand the dream, but you pursue it more efficiently. Here are the steps. 1. Identify and state the problem. 2. Generate a hypothesis on the basis of other people's data. This is basically what you think will happen. 3. Collect the data. 4. Draw some conclusions. When we apply the scientific method to life, we need to tweak it a little bit. 1. Identify the problem. 2. Think about what you expect and what you are afraid of, and then learn by watching others. 3. Collect the data by not only listening to yourself, but, when necessary or prudent, by asking others and seeking out other sources of information as well. At this point, it is important that you weigh these outside data, especially if they come from stakeholders, against what you know is right for you. 4. Execute your plan. Now, let's see how you can apply this method to weight loss. Step 1. I need to lose 40 pounds. Note, you've identified the problem. Step 2. I can't do it because I have never succeeded before. I love eating. I'm too busy. The kids make it difficult. And I hate to exercise. I will fail. The only thing I can do is starve myself, and then I will lose weight. Note, these beliefs are dangerous because they may trip you up, but if you listen to them, you may also learn more about your vulnerable areas and then pointedly address them. For example, have the kids clear their plates so you don't eat their leftovers. And wake up 15 minutes earlier in the morning to pack your lunch so you don't buy calorie-rich foods at work. Step 3. Make a food diary. Figure out your tough times of the day. Speak to a dietitian. Find an exercise plan that you enjoy. Watch the eating habits and patterns of folks who have succeeded at maintaining a healthy weight. Note, this is data. Step 4. On day 1, toss out the junk food. On day 2, start a food diary. On day 3, drink 2 liters of water. Note, you're executing your plan, solving your problem. You know you want to lose weight, and you know you have some hurdles to face, so you're going to use that data to develop a plan, evaluating the times of day you'll hit rough patches. You'll write down your foods in a log, collecting the data as you work toward achieving your goal or solving your problem. Then, with that data, you'll execute your plan, solving one problem a day, working toward the goal. There's a flip side to all of this, which is where the spider senses come in. The scientific method we're using to collect the data to solve the problem is based in logic. Identify problems, use information, and draw conclusions. The problem is that most of our big-ticket decisions are not so logical, and in fact are generally muddied by emotion, which we have already established can impact our decision-making. Spider senses are not always logical. Selling off all your stuff and moving to Europe is not logical in light of long-term financial planning. Getting a divorce and raising kids alone with fewer financial resources is not logical. Ordering a steak and leaving two-thirds of it behind is not logical. Here's the important part of this. Logic is not always right. Data and dessert. Losing weight benefits tremendously from data because it is a way of seeing change as well as tracking what trips you up. Food diaries are great because they not only reveal what you eat, but also when you eat it. Willpower research tells us that you are more likely to start making mistakes later in the day, so food diaries show us when to kick up the mindfulness. They enable you to log changes in your weight, in your dress size. They allow you to log times and situations that are challenging for you. They also help you to manage and organize your environment. If you know ice cream is your downfall, don't bring it into the house. If it's easy, you will eat it. I know that I have some places that still trip me up, and so, when I can, I avoid them, or I take the time to mentally prepare for them and talk my way through them, if necessary. The why. The trick to success is walking through the data minefield without blowing up, and to keep honoring your spider senses and integrating the data. Data can be your friend if you know how to use it properly. It can be your demise if you outsource your decisions to it and stop listening to yourself. Spider senses and data are not incompatible. In fact, they benefit from each other. The data are the sails, and the spider senses are the wind. The spider senses push the boat to the destination, while the data guides you in how to make that change. But at the end of the day, the wind, spider senses, is what pushes the boat to its destination, while the data may prevent you from crashing on the rocks, allowing you to enter the harbor more smoothly and efficiently. Be careful of stealth data. Marketers and the media are smarter than we are. We passively absorb the billboards, ads, and magazines that attack us at every turn. And with our smartphones and the internet, we receive a steady diet of ads we aren't even consciously aware of. The wedding with the white dress. The granite countertops. The right car. Just make sure they are what you want for you, and not what the world is telling you that you want. Don't binge on data, and don't cut it out of your diet entirely. Just like with food, it's important to find that balance. Denial of data is often a way of not tackling the decision. Remember, too, that data evolve, and while experience remains our greatest source of data, we have to remain open to other possibilities. The esteemed psychoanalyst Carl Jung once said, "Thoroughly unprepared, we take the step into the afternoon of life. Worse still, we take this step with the false presupposition that our truths and our ideals will serve us as hitherto. We cannot live the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning, for what was great in the morning will be little at evening. And what in the morning was true, at evening will have become a lie." Basically, even in our own lives, that which once worked may not work in the future, or at any given point in time. Balance the data, but listen to yourself. The now. I want you to do an exercise in your journal, and it may take some time. This exercise will help to guide you through this book in a way that makes it most useful for you. Write down one big decision that is on your mind right now. Are you struggling with a relationship, or your weight, or maybe your career. Just think of something that really matters to you in your life. In a separate place, write down what you want. Take a true moment to think about this one. Quiet the voices, and just record what your spider senses say. For example, you may want to quit school. You are terrified, and that is reinforced by the fact that no one wants you to do it. It doesn't matter. Just put down if that's what you want. Be open about what you write down. Include anything related to your wants as well. Maybe you want to quit school because you hate your major, you don't want to live there, or you want to pursue your goals as a musician. Don't judge your reasons. There are enough other people doing that. Now list all of the sources of data you could and typically would turn to for information on how to proceed. Here are some examples. Family, friends, co-workers, the internet. List specific websites if they would help in this process. Spiritual advisor, healthcare professionals, therapist, partner, mentor, children, guidebook, religious text, Reiki practitioner, book, song, television show. You name it. Then list what you think they would advise you to do. Yes, or don't do it. Or you're crazy. Or go for it. You are likely to list different things next to different stakeholders and data sources. Now, rate the quality of advice you think they would give you on a scale of 1 to 10. A rating of 1 implies completely uninformed, naive advice, and 10 is expert wisdom. Next, write down how you would feel if you did or did not listen to this data source. For example, you might feel guilty if you don't follow mom's advice, and you might feel foolish if you don't heed the advice of a mentor. Connect the dots. Think about which data sources will influence your spider senses. It doesn't mean you'll necessarily follow or ignore them, but you'll listen to them with a trained ear. Knowing the power of that data, advice from mom can really influence you. Advice from a book may not be as powerful. Turn to the data that you think will be the most useful. Tabulate it. Really assess your findings. Check in. Data. Here is some old-school decision-making work, but with a twist. The good old pros and cons list. These lists are simply a place to visually lay out the data you have acquired so you can make a decision. Take that thing you want to do and list out the pros and cons. Let's stick with the quitting school example here. Pros: you hate your program of study. It's too expensive. You want to pursue another goal. Cons: you're concerned that not having a degree will hold you back. You really like your classmates. Here's the new part. Your pros and cons list gets a third column, today and forevermore. It's the spider senses column. Make a note describing in detail what your spider senses tell you, because this means you have given the data its due, put it down, and thought about it. You have used it to inform what you may have known all along, but perhaps now know in a more informed way. This is not the school for me. I want to be a chef. I've always loved cooking. As you listen to this book, reflect back on this new style of pros and cons list, especially as you complete the remainder of the exercises. This book is one more source of data, so use it well to bolster your spider senses to achieve the body and life that you want. Chapter 7. The Promise of One. Great things are not done by impulse, but by a series of small things brought together. Vincent van Gogh. "There's no way," she said. "I love food too much. I don't know how to say no. I hate the gym. I don't even know where to begin." I have heard these words, or some approximation of them, countless times from clients, acquaintances, even strangers on buses and airplanes. Many times, clients come to me as the last stop on a long train ride involving dietitians, trainers, fad diets, juice machines, surgery, and medication. Making change is overwhelming, and nowhere is this more pronounced than in the realm of weight loss and management. When you wake up one morning and decide to take on a 75-pound weight loss, it seems impossible. You can't get your head around months of giving up sweets and going to the gym, but in fact, it is the sheer impossibility of getting your head around changing your life. And now we know that what seems like small choices, for example, saying no to dessert, are actually a dance through the minefield of the voices of others, fears from the past, present, and future, and the myths and scripts of our lives. So, what to do? In the rest of this book, we are going to take the concepts of spider senses and gatekeeping and apply them to food, love, work, and life. But this isn't just about knowing. This is about doing. You know what you need to do. Now I want you to do it. Use this book as a bridge to the life you want. I will start with a simple tool that will guide you through the journey we are about to take. The promise of one. It's simple. Does your life look the way you want it to look? No? Then enact your dreams with the promise of one. It will show you how to take all that you will learn from listening to this book and all of your experiences and make them work for you. I want your dreams to come true and your aspirations to be attempted. I want you to live the life you want to live. Dance to your music. Write your own script. Listen to your body and feed it accordingly. Now that you are listening to your spider senses, the promise of one will help you achieve the life you want. It will help you to overcome your fears, deal with your stakeholders, and knock out those infernal golden rules. It will help you to regain control and make you a better gatekeeper. The promise of one is based on goal setting and goal getting and is actionable and powerful. It is my simple method of setting and accomplishing goals in all aspects of your life. Food, job, money, dreams, and love. Instead of goal setting, I like to think of it as dream setting. Goals often feel sort of dull, but dreams feel powerful. Action can sometimes feel impossible, but the promise of one guarantees that you will reach your goals and experience your dreams, not just think about them. Goal setting is at the core of motivation and regulating ourselves. Here is the prevailing wisdom on goals. You need to set two kinds of goals, short and long term. Each feeds on the other. If you are good at something, then set that goal high. But if it is new or you are not good at it, set the bar at a more manageable level. If goals are set too high, the odds of failure, loss of self-esteem, and distress can stop us from reaching them. If they are set too low, we won't be motivated, and they won't be gratifying. To wake up and say, "I'm going to lose 50 pounds," is a lofty and overwhelming goal. That 50-pound loss requires a series of daily goals, like eating more fruits and vegetables, watching portion size, moving every day, and hydrating. But daily goals can feel tedious, and long-term goals too far away. We often feel stuck, so overwhelmed by the number of things that we want to change, that we end up changing nothing. It's not possible to build a house in a day, but when you watch a building go up in your neighborhood, you see the daily progress. Weight loss and life are no different. By keeping this to one action per day, initially, it keeps the goal manageable and starts a new habit on its way. The promise of one is about setting a foundation first, and this foundation is about taking the time and doing one thing each day. What happens slowly is that the requirement starts becoming a part of your daily routine, and in fact, you may want to do more than one thing per day to get where you want. You want to write a book or a screenplay? On the first day, you may just write down a paragraph. And while it seems like it may take forever at that pace, as you take the time and start the process flowing, listening to yourself and slowly moving forward, you will find that one day you can't stop yourself. The flow carries you forward, much like a sailor catches the wind, and off you go. It means doing one thing every day. The size of the action is not important. It's the mindful and purposeful moment you take each day to bring about a change. It's a tribute to you. And ultimately, it is about momentum. The why. The promise of one is like planting a garden. Initially, the process is slow. You till the soil, put down the seeds, dutifully water, and watch. Every day. In the beginning, it can feel pointless, just taking care of dirt. Then one day, the garden starts to flourish. Flowers and fruits, blossoms and broccoli, and you can't keep up with all of it. You keep doing your part, and it starts paying off. The wonder of the promise of one is that it stops feeling effortful, and before you know it, you grab the apple instead of the cookie. You exercise instead of sitting in front of the TV. You pursue goals instead of complaining about lost opportunities. And then, one day, your new garden is actually a life full of new healthy habits. You are spending time in a way that moves you forward and in the direction of what you want for you, rather than avoiding life because you are afraid of taking on dreams and challenges. At age 39, I set out to lose weight. For 510 days, I did one thing a day, and over time, more. For example, one day, I took the clothes off of the treadmill. The next day, I walked 5 minutes. The day after that, I took the 3 flights of stairs to my office instead of the elevator for the short trip. The next day, I switched from soda to tea. The next, I bought a case of water. After that, I drank 2 liters a day. So, as you can see, these are little things, but they added up to big change. Over time, doing one thing each day and listening to my spider senses turned these things into habits and also let me tweak the things that didn't feel right. Now I drink lots of water, but I'm not perfect and still succumb to the diet soda most days. Now I exercise nearly every day and always take the stairs, but I still struggle with food choices. The promise of one helped me to shed 85 pounds and gain a new healthy body and life. Every day since, these once-a-day changes have developed into permanent habits. I still have moments when I struggle, but I have maintained my healthy weight for 5 years so far. 2 years ago, I reflected on my life, my patients, and my message, and decided that I wanted to write a book. Many people said no to me. For 365 days, I did one of the following actions per day: emailing, researching, reading, writing, making phone calls, finding an agent. Then, a publisher bought the book. The promise of one turned into a dream, and the very book you're listening to. The now. The promise of one is a daily method to break down your goals in a manageable way. Follow these steps. Choose a dream and write it down. It can be something big like a 50-pound weight loss, a vacation, producing a documentary, or running for mayor. Or it can be smaller, like losing 10 pounds or cleaning out the garage. Each day, accomplish one thing toward that goal. This can be small some days, like eliminating all of the cookies and sweets from the house, searching the internet to find out how much a plane ticket costs to your destination, or sending an email about the evening photography class at your local college. It's just one task per day, and it may take only 2 minutes. Log your steps in your smartphone, computer, or journal. For example, Monday, tossed the sweets. Tuesday, bought strawberries. Wednesday, brought my healthy lunch to work. Thursday, walked 4 miles. Or it can look like this. Monday, emailed college. Tuesday, got response and returned email. Wednesday, purchased book on photography. Thursday, read one chapter of book. Let the promise of one guide you through the exercises at the end of each chapter as well. Even if you simply achieve one thing each day toward your dream, I promise you will make some significant shifts before you know it. Most important, you will find that taking these small steps toward your goal will become automatic, along with taking the time each day to step out of the mindless routine and turning it into mindful movement toward what you want for your life. Always listen to yourself, not just your spider senses, but anything that interferes with your spider senses or enacting your promise of one. Perhaps you are afraid of failing or succeeding, or your stakeholders are not supporting a change, or you are having trouble defying a long-held script like, good students don't take a year off to travel. The beauty of the promise of one is that you can often fight these big spider-sense scramblers by making smaller changes. On a day when you feel afraid of failing, make your one thing that you do more manageable. You are welcome to do more than one thing per day, but try to at least complete one step each day at a minimum. Label your journal accordingly, day one, day two, and so on. You will be amazed at your progress over time. Check-in. Promise of one. This is a simple check-in for you. Just do it. Build the promise of one into your life. Take one new step a day to put you on the path toward your goal. Ideally, I'd suggest you do it in the morning, because one step might lead to more steps that day, like a response from a job inquiry, for example. If you download the app that goes along with this book, you'll have the option of having me nudge you once a day, reminding you to do that one thing and get to the life you want. No excuses. After each chapter, think about the takeaway message of that chapter and use the promise of one to enact it in a manageable way. One day you throw out the sweets. Another day you eat half the sandwich. Another day you buy smaller bowls, and so forth. Part 2. Join the Dirty Plate Club. Chapter 8. How do you eat? I cannot remember the books I've read any more than the meals I have eaten. Even so, they have made me. Ralph Waldo Emerson. You think you're listening to this because you want to lose weight, and I am confident you will, largely by learning to walk away and leaning on your spider senses rather than your fears, the golden rules, and your stakeholders when making decisions about eating. But I promise you that once we lift up the hood and see what's underneath, you're going to learn about some other important elements in your life, including relationships, work, and how you spend your money. My hope is that as you listen to this book, you'll reap the same benefits my patients do when they walk into my office and learn to use these techniques. Even though listening to a book is not the same as sitting across from each other, the self-realization and transformation will be just as powerful. Let's take a look at the basics to determine exactly what kind of eater you are and the influences you have confronted in your life with regard to food. Let's understand you and be honest. This is the self-assessment stage. To really understand yourself and your eating, don't write down how you want to eat. Write down how you actually do eat. Once we understand this, we'll fix it by the end of the book. I promise. This chapter involves doing the exercises as you listen. I would recommend listening to it once and taking it all in, and then listening again with your journal by your side, so you can complete the exercises. Who, what, when, where, why, and how do you fill your plate? Let me ask you some questions and help you start this journey to a place where you can trust the finely honed machine that is you and create the life as you want it, instead of the life others want for you. It all starts with what you put on your plate and how you eat it. Who? The fundamental question here is, how do other people influence how you eat? Remember, the people who influence you are your stakeholders. People are food cues. Take a moment and reflect on how your eating habits differ depending on your company. Some people want you to eat the way they eat. Others don't care. In addition, people can influence the decisions you make about food. The mother who asks you why you aren't eating more. The aunt who tells you to eat less. The father who still wants you to clean your plate. Or the girlfriend who chastises you for not ordering dessert. Their words and wishes can lead you to ignore your wants, your knowing, and your spider senses. My eating habits. Now, get out your journal and answer a few questions. You can answer never, sometimes, most of the time, or all of the time. How often do you eat alone? How often do you eat with others? How often do you eat with children under the age of 12? Now, let's do some comparisons. And here I want you to think about how you typically eat. Typically meaning an average meal, the majority of the time. When you eat alone, how well do you eat? Worse than usual? The same as usual? Better than usual? When you eat with other people, how well do you eat? Worse than usual? The same as usual? Better than usual? When you eat with children, how well do you eat? Worse than usual? The same as usual? Better than usual? Now, let's think about the people you eat with. Some of them are what I term gut busters, the people who can throw off your spider senses with their words, their own eating habits, or even your history with them. List some of those people now, the people who make it hard for you to really honor yourself at the table. And when you list them, think about some of the reasons why that happens. For example, your answers might look like this. Gutbuster. Mary from the office. Why? She always orders appetizers and an entree and dessert, and she gives me a hard time when I don't do the same. Result. I find myself ordering more than I intended and feeling guilty during and after the meal. Now, list your spider sense supporters, the people who lead you to eat better, or, at the very least, the people with whom you do not feel compelled to eat in any way except the way you want. Here's an example. Supporter. My pal Lori. Why? She doesn't really care. I eat with her to enjoy her company, and she enjoys mine. We talk more than we eat during the meal, and she rarely wants dessert. Result. We often share an entree. I feel silly having dessert when she doesn't, and I leave these meals feeling full from the conversation instead of the food. Mistake meter. Which people do you find you most often make decisions with? I want you to really reflect on these answers in the who category. Are there major or even minor differences in your patterns of eating, filling your plate, and what you eat, depending on who you are eating with? Do children, yours or someone else's, influence your eating? Do you take on the eating habits of those around you? And if so, whose habits do you take on? Or are you consistent? Take a moment and reflect on